back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. While some drivers are obsessed with the speed, some others have a passion for the look of their cars. In Tehran, car tuning lovers have assembled for the biggest show of modified vehicles. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
Fast and furious. It's the biggest show of personal cars turned SUVs. Held in Tehran's Island Karting Track, the event brought together more than 500 motorists to flaunt their modified cars.
This is the only place where car tuning lovers can vent their energy and show off their beautiful cars. When I saw the call for such a big assembly of modified vehicles, I didn't waste a moment and decided to bring my car here.
Exhausts sound deeper, with flames popping out. Sound systems rattle the car roofs. And regular doors are replaced by butterfly doors, opening upward. To these people, car tuning is more than a hobby, but a passion. Majid says he has spent double the price of this Peugeot 206 to turn it into a green beast.
For us, our cars mean everything. To me, it's love. I save whatever I earn to spend on my car. So I urge the police to respect this love and stop fining us when we roll with our cars on the streets.
Based on Iran's traffic regulations, drivers are not allowed to alter the original design of their cars. Installing loudspeakers and noisy exhaust systems, and even attaching stickers, are associated with fines. Omid says he can't take this. He has transformed his Iranian-made car, dubbed Rana, into a whole new model, saying it looks better now on the street.
I spent whatever I could afford to make the streets look better with our cars, but the police are treating us like we are wrongdoers. I myself oppose dangerous driving in the city. What I want is just to make my car look more attractive.
Car tuning encompasses any modification to a vehicle that would lead to a higher engine performance and dynamic handling of the car. As long as these people stick to these rules, police will not have issues. Otherwise, they must keep these beauties inside their parking lots.
Thank you. However eye-catching they are, these mutated cars are no longer road pets and are good for drifting on tracks like this. Organizers say that's exactly why they held this show, to provide a chance for car-tuning maniacs to vent their energy in a safe place. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
الذي خلق السماوات والأرض وما بينهما في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش الرحمن فاسأل به خبيرا
He who created the heavens and the earth and what is between them in 6 days and then established himself above the throne, the most merciful. So ask about him one well informed.
Dear listeners, we were discussing the 59th verse of Surah Al-Furqan. الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ الرَّحْمَنِ فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا Who created the heavens and the earth and what is between them in 6 days,
Then he established himself on the Arsh. The beneficent God asked then from him, who is aware of everything. We concluded earlier that this verse is stating the power of the Almighty Allah in the entire universe. It is describing the assured trust in another way, which was discussed in the previous episodes. Anyway, the verse is stating that the creation of the world is gradual. And at the same time it is created, it is under the omnipotence and under the authority of the Almighty Allah. Because the verse says, ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. This beneficent God has established himself on the Arsh. And now that your God has such attributes, فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. Ask what you need from him who is aware of everything. So we understand that we must ask someone who is beneficent, who has the ability and the attribute of giving us something that we need. Ar-Rahman fas'al bihi khabira. This is the beneficent God that you should ask from. And asking is not a defect. There is no problem in asking. The main problem is for not knowing. And this is the true fault and defect. Not to have the courage to ask. So in Islamic literature, based on this school of thought, we must refer to the ones who are the experts in that field. فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. In every situation, in every aspect, we must refer to someone who is aware, who is completely expert in that field. And in our case, the field of living in the world and reaching salvation in the other is only on the hands of the Almighty Allah and His expertise. So this sentence, فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا, is, as a matter of fact, the result of the former discussions. It implies that the Holy Prophet ﷺ must declare that he does not want any reward from them, and they must trust Allah, who has all these attributes, that is. He is both the powerful, the beneficent, and all-merciful, all-aware, and omniscient. Thus, man must ask him whatever he wants.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The commentators have other opinions also about this sentence. They mostly have interpreted the Quranic word fas'al, ask here, as to ask questions or to question and not demanding. They say that the concept of this sentence is that if man wants to ask questions about the creation and power of Allah, he must ask Allah himself because he knows everything. And in this field, the field of creation and power of Allah, you have no one else to turn to. No expert is there but Almighty Allah. But some others have not only interpreted ask as ask question or to question, but also they say that the purpose of the Quranic word khabir is Gabriel or the prophet of Islam. That is, if anyone has the question about Allah's attributes, he must ask them. Of course, this last commentary seems very unlikely. Also, the commentary that says the meaning of fas'al is only to ask and to question and not to demand, and you should ask Allah himself if you have got any questions regarding the power and creation of Almighty Allah, is not seemingly very consistent with the former verses. So the meaning which says to ask Allah whatever what someone wants seems more probable, because the whole creation of this universe, all the creatures are created based on Almighty Allah's mercy, because the word Ar-Rahman is used in the middle of this verse. ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ الرَّحْمَنِ فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. He has established himself on the Arsh. He is the Beneficent. Now you should ask him because he is aware of everything. And not just the creation of this world is based on Rahmah. The whole creation of ruling, the creation of the human beings, the creation of the world, and also the system which is going to be held in hereafter and resurrection is also based on Rahmah. Because the Holy Quran says, كَتَبَ عَلَى نَفْسِهِ الرَّحْمَةِ لَيَجْمَعَنَّكُمْ. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. We thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for all His blessings, the greatest of which is the blessing of guidance. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Luqman says, وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا لُقْمَانَ الْحِكْمَةَ أَنِشْكُرْ لِلَّهِ. We gave Luqman hikmah, wisdom, and ishkur lillah. I don't want to discuss this right now for different reasons. Do the shukr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Be thankful. Rough translation right now, very rough. So it mentions the idea of being thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then saying that مَنْ يَشْكُرْ فَإِنَّمَا يَشْكُرُ لِنَفْسِهِ. Whoever is thankful towards Allah, it's for their own benefit. They're not helping God. They're not adding anything to God. They're not... It's for themselves. The only benefit that there is for shukr is for themselves. And then it starts to quote Luqman. The verses do. وَإِذْ قَالَ لُقْمَانَ لِبْنِهِ. Luqman said, remember the time that Luqman said to his son, وَهُوَ يَعِذُهُ, while he was advising him, يَا بُنَيْ لَا تُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ. Oh, my dear son, do not hold associates, partners with God. لَا تُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ. Don't be a believer in shirk and polytheism. إِنَّ الشِّرْكَ لَظُلْمٌ عَظِيمٌ. That's a quote from Luqman, which of course, when God says, we gave Luqman wisdom, and remember when Luqman addressed his son and said these words, that means approval. God is saying we gave him this wisdom. So these words are approved of. Although, of course, all of what is mentioned there that is telling us what Luqman told his son are things that we actually find in other verses of the Quran as well. But there's a reason why I'm emphasizing this. Then God changes that a little bit, and the language, at least, is that he's not quoting Luqman. وَوَصَّيْنَا الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ. It's like in brackets, the story is being told of Luqman addressing his son and talking to him. After their first point, which is not to be a polytheist, not to believe in multiple gods, not to hold any partner with God. Don't partner anyone with God and say that this person is also has some level of lordship by God in any way. No form of shirk. That was what Luqman said, and the Quran quotes that. Then in brackets, in a sense, punctuation that we notify the reader that this is it's in between a story, but it's not exactly part of that. Why God speaks in that way, it's a whole different story. Why are the verses like that? It's a whole different story. The point is here, this is not quoting Luqman. It's not a verse. All of it's from God. Sometimes God quotes a person, and sometimes God doesn't quote a person. This is not part of the quote. وَوَصَّيْنَا الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ. We advised the human being, بِوَالِدَيْهِ, to his parents, or in regards to his parents. حَمَلَتْهُ أُمُّهُ وَهْنًا عَلَى وَهْنٍ وَفِصَالُهُ فِي عَامَيْنِ. His mother, the human being's mother, a person's mother, bears him, وَهْنًا عَلَى وَهْنٍ, difficulty after difficulty. Again, rough translation. That's what I recall the meaning of وَهْن. That may not be very accurate. What I recall is that. The point we're trying to make is not regarding this. Go read the translation. From what I can recollect of my memory of the meaning of the words, is difficulty after difficulty, وَفِصَالُهُ. And so حَمْل, the pregnancy period that the mother carries the child in her womb, and then afterwards فِصَالُهُ فِي عَامَيْن, afterwards the child is dependent on the mother in her nursing him up to 2 years. All that period, all those difficulties. So it doesn't mention the father here. That's for another time. It's interesting. We advise the human being to the parents. And then the one that's mentioned is حَمَلَتْهُ أُمُّهُ. The mother is mentioned. What was, so this is, we advise towards parents, and then the mother is mentioned, what she went through for every person that is alive, that is born. أَنِشْكُرْ لِي. What's the advice? أَنِشْكُرْ لِي. Be thankful towards me. وَلِوَالِدَيْكَ. And be thankful towards your parents. Now, I don't want to focus about parents, that meaning of parents right now, because there's other things that are there that the whole package needs to be discussed. We've discussed it before, and we have all heard this idea. The only point I will say in regards to that is that, as you see here, it doesn't say be obedient. It says, Ishkur li wali walidayk. It puts shukr of Allah first, and then shukr, and being thankful towards the parents. And then that whole thing is connected to tawheed, to Allah, even what the parents do and what the parents go through. It's connected to Him. إِلَيَّ الْمَصِيرُ. What you are becoming is towards Allah. You are becoming towards Allah. You're moving towards Allah. Everyone is. Everything is. إِلَيَّ الْمَصِيرُ. Towards me is what everything becomes. Everybody, everything is moving towards Him. وَإِلَى اللَّهِ تُرْجَعُ الْأُمُورُ. Another verse that says the same, presents the same idea with different wording. It doesn't say obedience. It says be thankful. Being thankful is recognizing their effort in terms of the human being. It's recognizing their effort and appreciating it. That's what shukr means. In the context of the parents, appreciating the hardship they went through to raise us, to give birth, the mother is mentioned here first. That is a difficulty, a hardship that fathers just don't even understand. As much as we observe the process, perhaps to a degree, we don't feel it. We don't go through it. It's mothers that go through it. That's something that mothers need to be appreciated for. You need to recognize that, appreciate. She went through all that hardship to give birth to me, for me to be born, for me to exist. Now, I need to be appreciating that. Appreciating that means that if not just for the, that's where it started. And those are things that none of us can give back to our mother. We cannot go through such pain to serve our mothers. What we can do, however, is appreciating that effort. And as we said, it doesn't stop there. That's where it starts. They take care of us up to an older age, at least for the average person through their teen years. They take care of us. Appreciate that. You take care of your parents. This doesn't mean obedience. It's never mentioned that we advise the human being to obey the parents. It's never mentioned. Appreciate. They did that for you. You look for when, at whatever point, something that can help them, assist them, if you can, if you're capable of, with the conditions you have, with the obligations you have, you can, if you can provide that service, especially if they're now in need of you. That's where we have a lot of emphasis. There are times where the parents are now in need of the child and their support and their assistance and their love and their care. And then the child doesn't want to provide that care. The parents put up with all the whining, all the crying, that they didn't even know what the cause is. Now that parent is older in their age and every little thing bothers them in ways, as the Quran says, similar to a child. And I can't put up with the complaining or the special needs that my father or mother, especially the mother, has. That's where the Quran says that's not right. If the two of them get older with you and you are capable of taking care of them and just get upset because they have more needs and you get frustrated with that. No, لا تقل لهما أوف. It's like أوف is when you're frustrated. Like, oh, once this, can you turn this on? it's too hot, it's this. They may complain, they may get edgy, they may shout. Well, when you were a baby, you did all of that. They took care of you. Appreciate that. Don't say oof. It doesn't mean don't say anything that they dislike. Sometimes you got to say something. The Quran says, do amr al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar. We have right here. Amr al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar. Anyone who hears amr al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar, nobody likes to be criticized. Amr al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar is criticism. If you see your parents doing something that's wrong, you have a job, don't approve of it. They want approval from you, you can't give approval. They're not going to like it. Does that mean just, oh, I can't do that, I have to listen to my, I got to do, no, that's not what it says. It's not what the Quran says. People do that culturally, whatever, that's their thing. The Quran, don't attribute that to Islam. Islam does not say obey, and Islam does not say that taking care of them and not being upset with their demands and what they're asking of you in their old age because of their conditions, to be patient with that and don't express frustration. That doesn't mean that you're not allowed to say anything that they don't like. That's...
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Palestine declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Every year in the month of May, we remember the Nakba, or catastrophe, when in 1948, Zionists forced 750,000 Palestinians from their homes at the point of a gun. Of course, the Nakba didn't start in 1948. Palestinians were being displaced for decades before that. Furthermore, since the 1930s, Palestinian civilians have faced terror attacks by armed Zionist gangs. And the Nakba didn't end in 1948 either. Later in the show, we'll be looking at how Zionist forces are trying to censor and distort textbooks for schoolchildren in the hope that they'll never properly understand the Palestinian struggle. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi.
The 15th of May is a date etched in infamy, Nakba Day, the commemoration of the expulsion by Zionist terror of approximately 750,000 Palestinians. About 530 villages were ethnically cleansed and either destroyed or given new Hebrew names so that they could be colonized by Jews. For Palestinians, the Nakba is a continuing process still happening, indeed intensifying today. It is well known that the colonial power Britain was responsible for allowing the establishment of a settler colony in historic Palestine. Less well known is that recruits for the Zionist terror militias to take part in the Nakba came from Britain and other Western countries. In Britain, the Jewish agency set up a secret recruitment center in a London branch of the retail chain Marks & Spencer. After health checks, recruits joined the Haganah, or the elite Palmach, or strike force, both of which committed many atrocities against civilians, including castration. One of the youngest recruits from Britain was the internationally known hairdresser Vidal Sassoon, seen here in Palestine in 1948. The far-right terror militias like the Stern Gang and the Ergun were also active in Britain and dispatched perhaps 40 British recruits to the terror in Palestine. The Ergun recruited via a mass poster campaign under the cover name of the Jewish Legion, led by Major Samuel Weiser, the deeply racist public face of the group. All of the group's committed atrocities, including massacres of civilians. The atrocities have been covered up ever since by intimidations, ideology, and lies. Alternatively, the past has simply been erased by the destruction of Palestinian villages and their replacement with forests created by the Zionist Jewish National Fund. One even has the Orwellian title of Peace Forest and has been expanded in recent years via the demolition of Palestinian homes in Silwan, East Al-Quds. Shockingly, some are named after the countries from which funding for the ethnic cleansing has come, such as the British Park or the Canada Park. There are dozens of charities in the UK, US and Canada raising money to further the ongoing ethnic cleansing being committed by the settler movement with the support of the military and government. For example, the British Friends of Ariel University raises funds for a university built entirely on an illegal settlement. According to the UN, settlement construction is a war crime. A director of the charity, Benjamin Pearl, lives in Hendon, London. He currently faces no pressure to withdraw from his collaboration with war crimes. Here he is, pictured with four Conservative MPs. The history calls for a response in Palestine and elsewhere to shut down and dismantle the institutions responsible for the ongoing Nakba.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Dr. Garda Karmi. Dr. Karmi was born in Jerusalem, but her family was forced out of their home by Zionist colonists in 1948 when she was still a baby. The family moved to England in 1949, where she grew up and was educated. She practiced as a medical doctor for many years and has held a number of research appointments on Middle Eastern politics and culture. And she's a former research fellow at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter. Welcome to the show. Garda, I wonder if I could start with you. I mean, you've lived through that, and perhaps you could just give us the benefit of your reflections after all this time and all that suffering and the fact that people are still resisting.
Well, yes, of course, it's May the 15th. Will be the anniversary of the establishment of the State of Israel. Indeed, we were victims of that establishment. And I tell you, we were luckier than most because we got away to Damascus, where my grandparents lived. Many people didn't have that, and they became refugees instantly, and eventually the UN got them into refugee camps, which are still standing today. Mm-hmm. Now, in our own case, the shock and the trauma of that departure remained with my parents all their lives, I think. It was one of the reasons why they never talked about the time in Palestine. We didn't grow up with stories of, you know, when we did this and when we did that. They didn't want to talk about it. Yeah. And it's a terribly sad that in the end they wouldn't go, although I remember arguing that our country's still there. It's occupied by other people, but yeah, it's still there. They couldn't bear it. The idea that strangers were walking those streets, sure, pretending that they were natives was beyond them.
Indeed.
So it's been really difficult. Yeah. It's a terribly sad, tragic event which has not been sufficiently understood, not only by people outside but by Palestinians themselves. Mm-hmm. Because I think the trauma was so profound, it's taken decades to try and come to terms with it.
Well, we'll come to how the history has been concealed a little later in the programme. But David, I mean, people from Britain, British people went over to participate in the ethnic cleansing, didn't they, back then?
Yes, it's amazing. I mean, this is something which has been buried from history. You can read it if you read in detail all the historical accounts of the period. Marks and Spencer's had a secret recruitment centre for the Haganah to recruit militias to go and expel the Palestinians. And indeed, there was an anti-fascist group in London, the 43 group, which went over altogether to the Ergun, the far-right revisionist Zionist terror group, and they sent about 40 people to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians. People don't know that these were British Jews who went to shoot and to kill and to expel the Palestinians. And a truly shameful part of British history, which people have forgotten.
No, indeed. And I mean, God, I mean, as we've just heard there, I mean, you know, people going, many people from this country, many people from London went there and indeed came back. I mean, do you know whether, came back here, you know, obviously after they'd participated in this ethnic cleansing. I mean, do you know whether any of them faced any sanctions for that? And indeed, have you ever come face to face with any of those people that, you know, that participated in the Nakba?
No, they never came. They were never the object of sanctions at all. And that, of course, has been the story of Israel. Total impunity. Nobody ever holds Israel accountable and its supporters accountable for the tragedy of Palestine. No, indeed, they would have made account. I did not, fortunately, I didn't come across any of those people, but I tell you, what I came across was 1967 when Israel invaded and occupied the rest of historic Palestine. The number of Jews in this country, British Jews, who were prepared to go out to that area and fight on the side of Israel was phenomenal. And I well remember I think he was a grocer in Golders Green, where ironically enough my family lived. And I remember saying to him, why are you, he says, my shop will be closed because I'm off to Israel to help out. So I said, why are you doing that? He said, because we are under attack. Mm. And I was so struck by that. We? Who's we? Mm. This man was English, no, was a British person, as far as I knew.
Yes.
That was the kind of thing that went on.
No, indeed. And I just wonder if you'd maybe ask you, David, I mean, Vidal Sassoon passed away 10 years ago, actually, commemorated his anniversary of his death, I think, was commemorated recently by a prominent member of the Jewish socialist group. I just wondered what your thoughts were on what that says about how the Nakba is actually remembered in this country.
Yeah, and this was a guy called David Rosenberg. Yeah. He's a supporter of Palestinian rights. But he remembered the death of Vidal Sassoon for his involvement in the 43 group, an alleged anti-fascist group from the 1940s. Now, what's extraordinary about that is that Sassoon, as we saw in the film there, travelled to Palestine. He was in the Palmach, the elite strike force of the Haganah, and he said that was the making of his life. He would, you know, that participating in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine was an experience which stayed with him for the rest of his life. Now, what on earth are socialists, Jewish or otherwise, doing celebrating someone who participated in ethnic cleansing? This is a truly extraordinary thing. It says a lot about the way in which even pro-Palestinian people have a blind spot on the role of Zionism in our history.
Yes. I mean, I'm turning, if I can, Garda, to you about the, you know, the ongoing Nakba. I mean, we see the regular incursions at the Al-Aqsa, the demolitions, the brutality, the murders, the killings that you know, that are carried out on a, well, like a routine basis. I mean, what do you think that says about the current situation?
Well, first of all, remember that the war against the Palestinian people that Israel waged started in 1948 and before, and it was the aim of it was erasure. This is important for people to understand. The aim of the Zionists was to erase the fact that there had ever been anything called Palestine, or a native population called Palestinians, who had their own culture, their own customs, their own society. There was a ferocious attack on the history and the culture of the Palestinian people. And that started from, as I say, 1948 and before. Now, that's continued. So it's an ongoing process under which Israel has felt able to expel more Palestinians, take the case in Jerusalem's Sheikh Jarrah area, where people are fighting to stay in their homes even now and losing, almost losing the battle. So it's an ongoing attack. And as for killings, just a few days ago, the Palestinian journalist, Shireen yes. Abu Aqla, who is a marvelous woman who had been doing her job when the Israelis shot her and killed her in the Jenin area. You know, this is a very, very big enemy to fight, really. And when you earlier asked me how come the Palestinians are still standing on their feet, that is in itself truly remarkable.
It is.
Because this enemy is multi-headed. It's like a hydra. It's not just what we see in the shape of the Israeli army, but it's also the extended pro-Israel lobbies, the Jewish supporters of Palestine, even socialist Jews, as we've just heard, cannot, supporters of Israel, I meant to say, cannot stop themselves from being sympathetic to Israel.
And, you know, and further to that, David, I mean, we've got charities, haven't we, you know, supporting, I mean, for example, Oriel University, you know, based on an illegal settlement, supported by a charity, a British charity. I don't know, is that widespread? I mean, and, you know, how is this happening? I mean, British charity supporting what effectively a kind of war crime?
It's not one charity. There is one charity which supports the university. There's another charity which supports the settlement itself. And there are scores of charities in this country which are devoted to illegal settlements, to war crimes, to supporting
war crimes. Yeah.
And they have... they're allowed by the Charity Commission to be charities because they say that they have public benefit. It's not a public benefit to commit war crimes in occupied territory occupied by the State of Israel. Mm. And so there's a real issue here, is that there's no pushback against this in this country. And these are organisations which should be dismantled. The people who are involved in them should potentially be considered for being accessories to war crimes. And yet they walk around our streets without any pushback.
Indeed. Well, I mean, that's certainly something that we need to take up beyond this show for sure. But we're just going to have to leave it there, if we can, because we've got another report now coming up to look at how Zionist lobby groups are censoring and distorting Palestinian history.
After eliminating the Palestinians from Palestine in the Nakba, the apartheid entity is acting through proxies in the UK and US to erase traces of the Nakba and the Palestinians' heroic freedom struggle from the pages of school textbooks. In Britain, they've used proxy groups, the Board of Deputies, which has a, quote, close working relationship with the Israeli embassy, and UK Lawyers for Israel, which works with the Israeli Foreign Ministry to edit textbooks. In a report on their efforts by the British Middle East specialist, it was found that the lobby groups carried out hundreds of changes, an average of three per page. In the first version of the textbook, Jewish terrorism was mentioned 10 times and Palestinian terrorism 32 times. Following the lobby intervention, there were only 4 references to Jewish terrorism and 61 to Palestinian terrorism. The report found the edits were not simply more pro-Israel than their original versions, but dangerously misleading. Henry Maitlis, Emeritus Professor of Education at the University of the West of Scotland, stated that the books are now in danger of being seen as propaganda. The team of pro-Israel propagandists that worked on the edits was the Board of Deputies International Relations Officer, who identifies herself as Israeli, Talia Ingleby, and Suzanne Storing, Richard Millett, Jonathan Turner, and Caroline Turner of the UK Lawyers for Israel. In the US, the situation is markedly worse, with an actual Israel lobby group parading as a benign educational body. The Institute for Curriculum Services claims to have influenced the US education system in 50 states and impacted the studies of 11 million students. It's also hosted workshops in 90 US cities with over 6,000 teachers participating. The changes ICS has requested include replacing the word settlers with communities, deleting the word Palestine and replacing it with Judah, changing the phrase Jews settled there to Jews joined those Jews already there. It even suggested removing an exercise to write an unbiased essay on the issue of West Bank settlements. It has also requested the deletion of references to Palestinian cultural heritage and tried to change school maps to include illegally occupied lands as part of Israel. The ICS is a project of the Jewish Community Relations Councils, a charity it uses to protect itself. It also receives money from the Schusterman Family Foundation, which also supports a project of the notorious Israel lobby group AIPAC. We can reveal that the deputy director of the Institute for Curriculum Services, Bella Ben-Sack, formerly worked for the Israeli Ministry of Tourism. Also, Rick Brody, a former analyst at ICS, was previously employed at Birthright, the Israeli operation to encourage Jewish children to become colonists. So here we have proxies of the Zionist regime working to mislead children in Britain and what they learn about the ongoing Nakba.
David, there seems to be a concerted effort by the Zionist lobby to rewrite history, doesn't there?
Well, there is. I mean, Gara was talking about this earlier and saying it's been in operation since 1948 at least. But I think the thing to recognise here is that they still need to do this. They haven't succeeded in doing it. They have been successful in many ways, but they haven't succeeded in erasing the alternative narrative, which is the truth about what happened in Palestine, the occupation.
I mean, Gara, I know that you've pushed back against these Zionist falsifications, haven't you? I wonder if you could maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I really hope David is right, that we are still, our version is still pushing through, because my anxiety is this campaign to erase Palestine from history and from the map is pretty sophisticated, and it's run by totally dedicated zealots who will stop at nothing, it seems, to demolish every idea that that Palestinians ever existed or they had any kind of culture, etc., etc. So it does, it really worries me, this. It's utterly pernicious. And it's a very, you can see why the Zionists have opted for that. Because if you can distort the story from the beginning and you influence school children, then they grow up with this pro-Israel bias and ignoring the Palestinians. So we've tried, we made a group as part of BRICUP, which is this British Committee for the Universities of Palestine. We tried to, and we took on some key textbooks for children on the Middle East. I can report a success in that endeavor because the publisher, Pearson, was so flustered by our counterattack, the way we demonstrated by studying the text that had been altered by the Zionists, we were able to point out to them the kind of falsifications that had entered into it. They've actually withdrawn their textbooks. Mm. So that was really a little success.
Yeah,
but it's ongoing. They've got the European Union now trying to alter, to forbid certain textbooks from being taught. I think in the same sense as David is saying, we're still around, that they always have to think of how to damage us in the next step. The trouble is they're still around.
Yes.
From my point of view, they're still around.
Well, David, tell us about this US-based group that's attempting to distort history.
Well, it's more sophisticated than some others. And so, I mean, I think Gareth is right that there is a sophistication here in that it's part of a charity. So it pretends to be a charitable foundation only interested in educational matters. And it uses that charity to defend itself as a kind of shield against criticism and against the idea that it's actually an Israel lobby group, which, of course, it is. So that's a kind of more sophisticated strategy than they've been using, for example, in the UK, where they've put in lobby groups like the Board of Deputies or the UK Lawyers for Israel, which is a really extreme far-right pro-Israel lobby group, and that exposes them quite a lot. So it's been more successful, but it's now being exposed, and there's some pushback against it, and it's good to see that. We see the pushback, I think, in part because the resistance remains in Palestine. And that is that's the lodestar of these kind of debates. I mean, we see these things happening in the UK and the US, but if it wasn't for the resistance in Palestine, these would be much less successful, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the thing to watch. When the resistance is successful in Palestine, then we will see the debates in the UK and the US and Canada and elsewhere will be won toot sweet.
I mean, God, the attempt to distort history, the propagandizing is kind of, it's nothing new. I wonder whether you could say, I mean, what do you think that says about the current situation? And indeed, what more could people do perhaps to resist and to push back against these distortions, these propagandizing, which we see the Zionist lobby indulging in, which they seem to get quite a lot of support, from the corporate media, don't they?
They do. But, the first step in all this is to understand and appreciate the size of the assault on the Palestinians. I think a number of activists and supporters tend to underestimate the skills and the malevolence of the other side. It has to be understood that in order to defend and support this Zionist apartheid state that is called Israel, in order to keep it going, it has an army of warriors and soldiers everywhere, supporting it, defending it, etc. So that's, you understand the size of the enemy. Now, having done that, we must be not only vigilant, but constant in our efforts to counter it and to be actually even proactive. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that I have had with the solidarity movements for Palestine and the Palestinians themselves is that they are reactive. They need to be much more proactive. Yeah. They have to look at the chinks in the armor of Israel and try and exploit and get in through those chinks, so that we're doing a proper fight back, not just the defense.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, both of you, because unfortunately we've run out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge,